pulling back the curtain of silence.
And learning what freedom feels like. I'm Nick.
And I'm Lala.
This is Seen.
Brown-eyed activism.
Healing at the intersections.
When I was a kid, I would have these reoccurring dreams, probably from the ages of like maybe 6 up until like 13. And I loved, like, I hated sleeping, but I loved this dream. And I became really fond of it because it would happen so often. And I remember feeling so excited to like fall asleep, because when I would have a dream, I would always try to find my reflection. Mm. I think I was probably watching like way too much Mulan and like was like, when will my reflection show, kind of thing. Oh. But I remember like trying to find my reflection in mirrors a lot in my dreams, because lots of my dreams would take place in familiar places like my house. And I would love to take a look at my reflection, because whenever I would do that, I didn't look like myself. I didn't have brown skin. I didn't have like braids or tutas is what we used to call them, like dookie braids or like plaits or cornrows or something like that. No, I always had like really fair skin and blue eyes and like blonde hair that I could run my hands through. And I loved this dream so much. I remember feeling like that was the most beautiful version of myself was in my dream. And I would always feel like the morning came at such a loss, because I recognized that like whiteness and being beautiful meant being white, and it didn't mean being black. Dreams are just that, they're dreams, but they can also give us some sense as to how we see ourselves and like what place we take up in the world. And I don't have those like reoccurring dreams about wanting to be like a little white girl anymore, which is great. But and it's funny, I think it's like kind of funny, but also that dream was pretty consequential in my life, because it, despite having parents who really affirmed my beauty and the beauty of my sisters as like little black girls, I still somehow subconsciously got this idea that being beautiful meant being like blonde haired and blue eyed. And looking back at that, it's like pretty heartbreaking, you know? Yeah.
Yeah. Hearing it now, it like breaks my heart.
Yeah.
And when I first heard you tell that story on the radio, I was sitting in my room by myself and I literally gasped, because I used to have a recurring dream where I would look in the mirror and I had green eyes.
Yeah.
Yeah. And
how old were you when you had that dream?
From like, I think when I was a teenager until like my early
20s. Wow.
Yeah.
Wow.
Yeah. And way more embarrassing than that to admit is that I used to wear green contacts.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because I think I internalized kind of the same message, and I just always had the knowledge that looking the way that I look, that people didn't notice me, or that people didn't see who I really was, you know, that people like had these ideas about me, that they flattened me,
yeah,
you know, and saw me through this sort of lens of like a stereotype.
Yeah.
You know, and I think it was just before I had any language or analysis to understand why, I could tell that, you know, having brown skin and brown hair and brown eyes, that's not special and that's not worthy of, you know, love and attention.
Right.
Right. So I didn't wear the contacts because I wanted to be white, but I wanted to be noticed, I guess, or I wanted to be special, or I wanted to be seen.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think like that's the crux of what we're trying to have, you know, these conversations, and why we're doing this podcast, is just to kind of have honest conversations about what it means to walk through the world as you are and accept that.
Yeah.
Because sometimes for me, I feel like I walk through the world and people, like, I'm a dark-skinned black woman. I'm not very racially ambiguous, and people will see me and they'll see a black woman. But I oftentimes wonder if I'm just, like you were saying, seen through this lens or this gaze that doesn't come with all of the complexities of what and who I actually am.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. And then those perspectives, they're so forced on us, right? Mm. Because white people have their perspectives sort of reified everywhere. You know, that's the voices you hear most often in the media. Like, that's who most of, almost all of my teachers were. That's who,
right,
you know, most of my job interviews have been with. That gaze.
It's the default gaze.
It is the default gaze. And then it stops us, you know, we have to cater to that gaze.
Yeah.
And then at a certain point, we don't even know when we're doing it anymore.
Right.
Right? Unless we're working really hard. Yeah.
Yeah. And I feel like we always talk about the beauty of our friendship is, because it's actually kind of a fresh friendship, which is funny, because it's so deep and has so many layers. But the fact that we can sit with each other and be honest about our own personal experiences and, like, fuck up and say things and be like, oh, I actually don't think that's correct, or, like, you know, have, like, yeah, have this supportive environment for us to be who we are and not mince words. And that's really my hope, and the impetus of this is just to, like, do what we usually do, but just put a mic in front of both of us.
Yeah, because our friendship, like, this is one of the few spaces and my entire life, really, where I feel like I can be the fullness of who I am, or mm-hmm. I can say exactly what I think, yeah, and I can say it with, like, the fullness of my emotion and energy, yeah, and I don't have to worry about being too much, yeah, or, you know, I can, like you said, fuck up and be messy and, like, find my way. And
yeah,
I think, you know, that's something that we really talked about with this podcast, is that Black and brown women haven't been allowed to exist in the world as the fullest expressions of who we are and who,
right,
we can be.
Yeah.
And so in trying to become that in, for ourselves, you know, like, we need the support from each other. Like, we need the spaces where we can test our growth and, like, support each other to do that work. The learning and the unlearning.
Totally. And, like, show up and be the fullest expressions of ourselves and not have to, like, parcel out certain aspects of our identities, because that idea that, like, I have to be a woman but I can't be a Black woman,
yeah,
like, it's like, okay, well, those are two things that are inextricably linked to each other, like,
yeah,
I'm both Black and a woman. We often have specific experiences that pertain only to those people who are in that demographic or that group of people,
mm-hmm,
and so I think the special thing with us is that there's never that need to, or that worry for me, mm-hmm, anyways. I guess I can speak for myself. I'm speaking for you too, though. Is that, like, I feel like we both have the ability to speak our truths in their fullness. And, like,
yeah,
you said, I think Black and brown women don't have enough spaces to do this.
Yeah.
And so we firmly believe that we deserve, period. We deserve to have our stories told. We deserve, mm-hmm, to have our narratives shared and expressed, conversations where we don't have to pander, because that's really motherfucking exhausting.
Mm-hmm.
Living in a world where you don't see representations of who you are, and when you do, they're not quite accurate. They're not quite, and they're not good enough. That's another piece. And so I think one of the things that I always want to do is to take the time and opportunity to create those new representations. And what we're doing right now is creating representations of brown and Black women as we see them, as we actually live that experience.
Exactly. Yeah. And so I really want to help create this space with you where we're saying the things that I need to hear, right? Like, I need to hear Black and brown women saying exactly how they feel without worrying about, you know, who's going to judge us, holding each other accountable, you know, to our shared values, like yes. teaching each other, right? Learning from each other, making mistakes together, sharing, you know, like yeah. solidarity with each other, all of those things.
Totally.
Like, that's what I need to hear. And so that's what I want to say.
Yeah, that's what we want to do.
Yeah.
But before we even get into that stuff, why don't we like just maybe do a couple of like some 10 questions type shit.
Yeah.
Ask each other some, like, get you all who are listening to know a little bit about us.
Yeah.
So I'm going to start off with you. If you could, ooh, this is going to, you're going to roll your eyes because this is what everybody always does, especially people of color. But I'm going to make it complicated.
Uh-oh.
If you could go to any period in time
ooh.
With respect to when this timepiece had bumping ass music, where would you go in time? This is about music and history.
Wait, what?
So, like, I'm going to answer the question for myself.
Okay.
Because I'm probably not very articulate. So, I'm asking you, like, where in history would you go to be, like, front and center with, like, good-ass music?
Okay.
So, for me, probably, like, the 70s. Mm. I really love soul and funk.
Okay.
I love soul and funk, and my partner and I always like playing like Curtis Mayfield and like Marvin Gaye in the house, and like I will raise my children on that shit because it is good for your soul. It is really good for your soul, and I find really nourishing. So that's mine. But
okay,
yours?
For me it would be just like a tiny bit later, because it would be like the birth of hip hop and rap.
Gotcha. Okay.
Because it's like been like one of if not the most important like cultural force for me in my life.
Her and eyes so, are
like,
welling up right now.
So to see like the birth of that, especially yeah. because it's like so relatively recent.
Totally.
To just see how it like organically developed, it's so incredible and so like storied to me. So
yeah.
I would love to see that.
Yeah.
Who is your celebrity crush right now?
Oh my God. Amanda Seales. I know you're not surprised.
Yeah, you.
I love her.
Anyone who knows
I
Nick
love her.
Knows that she loves Amanda Seales.
She'll be singing, like, honestly, on a daily basis. I'm like, where's. Because there was a couple of. Recently, she took a hiatus from social media, and like myself and
what?
Other people from social media who like love Amanda Seales and count on her like Instagram stories yeah. and stuff were like, where the fuck are you?
Yeah.
Like, people were like, and then like a lot of us were like, okay, we know that you're stressed, like, we know that you got shit going on, we know you need time to rest. Like, I just love the community that she's kind of championed and cultivated, because she's like a no nonsense, hard hitter,
yes.
multi hyphenate,
yes,
bae.
Yes.
So it's like, I want her, but I want to be like her.
Yes.
And it's like
all
ultimate
it.
Crushing on that
amazing.
Shit. You know
yeah.
what I'm saying? Yeah.
Who's my celebrity crush?
Yeah, who's your... You're like, ask me, bitch.
No, I'm asking... You know who it is.
Oh. Lena Waithe.
Yes. I'm
obsessed if with I got Lena that Waithe. Wrong, you'd be like, get the fuck out of this podcast.
We're done. Watch The Chi. It's
yes.
on Crave. It's on Showtime. Watch Boomerang. She just got another show picked up by BET.
So she's
20s.
Now executive producing how many?
Well, she just got a third one picked up. Plus, she's going to be like acting on Westworld. She does everything.
Oh my God.
She can write everything. And she is amazing and perfect.
Okay.
We'll talk about her a lot more. Also, she has her moon in Sagittarius. I'm just saying.
Okay, this bitch is on
one. On that note, what's your big three? Sun, moon, rising.
Oh, my son, you're gonna like get mad at me because you already know these fucking answers. So my moon is in Gemini. My rising sign is Scorpio. My sun sign is Aquarius.
Did you say that one last because it's like the most important?
Yeah, obviously. Yeah. Like, I don't even really know what my rising sign in Scorpio truly means, but I totally get what my Gemini like moon means and my like sun in Aquarius, because like Aquariuses, we be out here just with the duality and shit, and Premila is like the person who like does all my astrology readings and sends me things about my, because the reason why we are actually friends sitting here doing a motherfucking podcast together is because at some point we have a friend in common actually who moved away, and she had a going away thing, and we like met through that, and I found out that Premila does like chart readings, and I was like, okay, I want to support this woman and her like local like her business situation, so I was like, yo, can you do my reading for me? And then Premila did my reading, and at this point I didn't really know her, and we met at Sunset Beach. It was a fucking date. And then she like, we spent like 3 hours at the beach, and the bitch just read my fucking life, and I was like, yo, so we gotta be friends now because you know too much shit about me. And that's how that started.
True.
Right?
Yes.
Sun, moon, and rising?
I am a Sagittarius sun, Leo moon, double fire there, and then Pisces rising.
No one's even surprised about the first two. Like, honestly,
stop.
You're like, I'm because my sister's a Leo, and she's just like, have you met my sister, my older sister, before?
No.
She's just like, she shows up and she's like, walk into the room, bitch. What? Like, you can't fucking, you can't miss her because she's just like,
am I
notice
like
me?
That, though?
No, you're not. But like, it comes out moon. Sometimes. It comes out moon. Sometimes. Yeah, exactly. Like when we're together, listen, y'all. Like when we're together, the Leo fucking right, like that bitch, she's on one. So, and if you don't realize, I'll say bitch a lot, it's always with love and affection.
With love,
it's always with love and affection. What is your what's your most recent fashion find that you are real happy about?
Fashion find. Okay, so this is some would say a controversial choice. So
I'm gonna be like Nikes. I burned them up.
Stop.
Just kidding. This is not the space for that shit.
No, that is offensive. I got a belt bag recently. We used to call them fanny packs. Oh. They've been rebranded as belt bags.
Wait.
Mine is amazing.
Wait.
Stop.
Stop. You got, they don't call, this is not a fucking belt bag. This
yes,
is,
it is.
This is a fanny pack.
Okay, it's 2019. They're called belt bags now.
Oh my God.
You oh wear my them across God. Your body.
Oh my God. Yes, they're a cross body bag now.
Yeah, that's what, yeah. So
where'd you get yours from?
Aldo, and it's like this like translucent, like it has all these like different colors and okay. It like shines and it's amazing. My little sister like doesn't want to associate with me anymore, but I don't even
Sinead,
care.
What's up, girl? I'm with you.
No, you're wrong. You're both wrong. Aquarius might be my favorite sign, but you're both wrong.
Gang, 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 Aquarius is gang up on Premola. Because that's like a, I mean, you know, on one hand, I appreciate it because it's like utility. I appreciate hands-freeness. But like, you're like hype bae. You're like hype beast bae now.
What?
Like, that's what the hype beast kids do with the fucking like.
I mean, I'm what in my 30s.
You're not
I'm
too old to know what that shit
Stop
means.
It.
You're like,
I am.
What?
No, I am. I'm like, I'm really in my 30s right now. Let's move on. If you could magically become fluent in any language, what would it be?
Arabic.
Okay. Why Arabic?
It's beautiful. And so many people speak Arabic around me. And my friend, Sarah, sometimes she switches from English to Arabic because she's like, fuck, bitch, I always think you speak Arabic. All the time. She's Egyptian. So she's just like, she talks, you know. Anyways, I want to know that shit. Also, can I pick another language too?
Yes.
Luo. That is an ethnic enclave language of my people.
Okay.
So my family's from Kenya. That's my background. And I understand some Luo, but.
Do your parents speak
it? My parents speak it. Okay. My mom speaks it. Actually, my aunt came over this weekend and she called her father, which is like my mom's great uncle. And he was speaking in Luo and he was like talking to me and I picked up like five words and felt like a total just failure. So I need to learn my own language and Arabic.
Yeah.
What is the last thing you listen to? And this could be music, this could be a podcast.
The last thing I listened to was a podcast. It was a podcast called Medicine for the Resistance. And it was talking about indigenous futurism.
Ooh.
Which was like a really cool, like I've read some like Afrofuturist novels. And this was kind of my first exposure to indigenous futurism. So I added some books to my reading list. Yeah. I need to ask you this question because I don't know the answer and I really need to.
On blast. What are you going to ask me?
Desus or Mero?
Oh my God.
If you have to choose one.
Oh my God.
And if you all don't watch Desus and Mero on Showtime, watch it.
Yes. The kid Mero. He's so funny. He's just the funniest fucking dude to me. Like, how many times have you watched Desus and Mero and you're like, Mero's high? Every time I watch that shit, he's like baked for sure.
Since they got on Showtime, I feel like they're less stoned on air.
Are you serious?
You don't think
no,
so?
No. Look at his eyes, man. Okay. They're always just bloodshot red. And the shit that comes out of his mouth is just like, you can tell.
They're so funny.
They're so funny. And there's nothing like watching like Black Boy Joy for me. I love seeing black men like giggle and have fun and just like enjoy themselves. And also just flex really hard that they're on Showtime now.
His laugh is like really infectious.
Totally.
For me, it's Desus though. He's like the cutest. Like,
cute. Yeah. I know. I wish I appreciate him because he's the balance that we all need.
Yeah.
Like,
yeah.
I think Mero's just like on one all the time. Like, he'll like roll around and shit. You're like, what the fuck? Get up, nigga. Get the fuck up. So So I think we spent some time having a little bit of fun, but I would like to maybe ask some questions that are a little bit more pointed, because I think it's great for us to share with folks like why we're doing this podcast with respect to ourselves and who we are. So question for you is like, how do you identify?
Yeah, so that's a big question. Mm-hmm. So like my go-to is to always say that I'm a queer woman of color. Mm-hmm. There's more that's important for me to say, but within the time constraints. So my dad is Indian, specifically Malayali, and he grew up in India before moving here. And then my mom is white and she grew up here. So I identify as brown. That's a political identity, but we'll maybe go into all of the ins and outs of that in another episode.
Yeah.
But I also feel like it's really important to understand myself as a settler and as non-Black, because those are huge sources of structural power that I need to reckon with. And it's also important in the same way to understand myself as a cis person. So, yeah, those are some of the major ways that I occupy a space in the world. Mm. And it's non-exhaustive, but
et cetera, et cetera.
Et cetera, yes.
She says. So how did you develop the political lens you have now? Because I think we're both like decently well-ish, reddish kind of sort of educated people. But like, what's been that journey for you?
Yeah, so politics have emerged really naturally for me. So I remember, like, before I knew about anti-oppression and critical theory, I was still always, like, looking around and understanding things as, like, right or wrong.
Yeah.
So, like, in high school, I wrote an article for the school paper that was about male teachers sexually harassing students, which was something that I had noticed. And I didn't have any exposure to any feminist analyses of sexual harassment
right.
and sexual violence. Like, nobody taught me that, but yeah. it was something that I noticed, you know, as
yeah.
wrong.
Yeah. So you were just, like, out there burning the bras at a young ass age.
Kind of. Like, it's so weird to her. I'm like, I don't even know where that
baby
came
Pamela was
from.
Political.
Yeah.
That's very unsurprising. I remember I wrote an article. This is a total segue, but, like, also on tangent. Mm. I totally wrote something in my English 11 class, and it was about, like, feminism in the modern woman in a Christian school. And
Whoa.
My English teacher gave me like 100%, and she was like, yo, that's just on point. That was like I had one teacher who really championed the things that I would say and things that I would write.
Wow.
Up until this point in time, she still follows me on Facebook, and she will always like shit that I post.
That's incredible.
Yeah.
She's like did you see Cardi B's high school like AP history teacher or something?
No,
who
tell
stood
me
up
more.
For her recently
no.
in the media, because someone was saying, oh, Cardi shouldn't be speaking of politics. And she is like, actually, she was like in my AP whatever
no
class
way.
In high school, and she was incredible, and she's always been really brilliant, and so you should all shut the fuck up.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
So that was amazing.
Okay.
Anyways, politics for me like really came into focus in university. It started because so I was sexually assaulted in university, and that wasn't the first time that it happened to me. That happened to me in high school as well, but the difference was that in university I had met my best friend who had been sexually abused as a child, and she was already in therapy for that.
Yeah.
And we just had such a close relationship that when it happened, like, I told her about it. I didn't have those words for her yet, but I just told her what happened. And, you know, she was angry for me. And, you know, we started talking about it, and we started talking about, like, why these things were happening so much, and, like, no one seemed to care, or why when I tried to talk about it, it felt so bad, you know, like what people would say. And then by this time we had just gotten onto like Facebook. And so some of these conversations, we could find the conversations. And that's when I started to learn that there was language around all of these things, around like rape culture and sexism, and then racism also. And then all of this, like, these whole other like host of experiences that I'd had but had never had language for. I never had anybody to validate me and tell me I wasn't just like crazy or sensitive or but the fact that it started with trying to process my experiences of sexual violence is really significant for me, because the relationship between healing work and politics has always been so foundational for me. And those were the experiences that led me to become a therapist. So now I'm a therapist. I have a private practice. And I'm so blessed and honored to be able to say a lot of my clients are queer and trans people of color, and oppression and racism and all of these things are things that we talk about like every day. So that relationship there with healing work and liberation work is the key for me, and it always has been, I think.
Yeah. And so it sounds like you get to really like live out your values in your regular life, and then you get to take that to work. That sounds like a fucking awesome thing for you.
I do get to do that, and it is incredible, and I'm still a new struggling entrepreneur, and I still work in the service industry. So, I've been in that job working as a server in like a white dominated environment for the better part of a decade.
Wow.
And the struggle of doing like really demanding work in a role that's like really low status, and people treat you like shit and exercise like that little bit of power that they feel like they have because, you know, they're in a customer is always right situation and they get to tip you.
Right.
That is like a major part of my life. And it's just as much a part of my lens as my work as a therapist.
Yeah.
The same way like growing up in a white household in rural BC, because I was raised by my white mother and my white grandparents. Mm. And those white people loved me so much and gave me so much, and also like unintentionally denied and dismissed and gaslit me about my feelings and my experiences as a brown girl.
Yeah.
And those things make me who I am just as much as the things that would seem more like on brand
right.
for me.
Yeah.
It's complicated.
It is complicated for sure.
Yeah. So how about you? How do you identify?
Question. Just spin it out for me, woman. I'm a black woman. I am like first gen or whatever, second gen. I don't even know because I keep on looking up like, am I first gen or second generation? My mom was born in Kenya. My dad was born in Kenya. They immigrated here.
First generation because you're born here, right?
Actually, there's a lot of like confluence between first gen and second gen. And there are some people that would qualify me as second generation for whatever reason. It's
weird.
It's a really, really weird nuance, but whatever. My parents aren't from here. I have several sisters. I have three sisters and one half sister. I grew up in Vancouver, or unceded Musqueam First Nation territory. I am a new queer. I've just recently kind of inducted myself into the land of bisexualism. I'm in a really happy relationship with a man, but like that doesn't mean anything. I mean, that means a lot, but like that doesn't mean anything with respect to my bisexualism. Like,
yeah,
I fucks with women too, and like gender nonconforming folks too, because like, you know, my family's from Kenya, and I hold like privilege as a cis person, as a cis person, and as just like a person who's really educated. I recognize that. That's a thing. I'm also a survivor of violence, of sexualized violence. And so that's another, I guess, part of my identity, a big part of my identity, actually.
Yeah. So what has been your journey in terms of like refining your personal politics, or what does personal politics even mean to you?
Personal politics for me is like, I know a lot of people will be like, but your personal politics is the lens you wear. And for me, I'm like, I feel as though the lens you wear can be something more performative. And I think personal politics is more like a callus that you build over time, because you can like file those suckers down, but you still have the callus that builds up. And that is, those are things that I think I wear them on my body as I live and breathe and like take up space in the world. So I grew up black in Vancouver, and from a young age became really aware of the fact that there's not many black people in the city who look like me or my family. And then I also grew up in the church from like age 6. And then in addition to that, I went to Christian school from like age like 8 till 18. And so all those things are a really powerful combination, I think. I learned a lot of positive things about like going to church. I think it helped me understand like how to be like a compassionate person and like how to like think about other people. But I would say there were a lot more takeaways that were damaging rather than positive. I remember feeling like a lot of terror, which I've had to like actively unlearn even till this day. I have a lot of Christian guilt, but I had a lot of terror because I always felt like I wasn't good enough to go to heaven. And I actually remember feeling guilty that I didn't want to go to heaven because heaven sounded boring. I literally remember like I know this is a fact that I had to like
Aquarius.
Think about. Oh my god, I was like, what am I gonna do, praise Jesus all the time? That's gonna be so boring. I'm definitely going to hell. And yeah, there were like a lot of times where I really hated myself and I had a lot of like worry and anxiety about who I was, and that really compounded into self-loathing and shame. And then there was like the internalized anti-blackness, and it was a lot of anti-blackness, and I think that followed me up until university. And it was only really after high school where I began to really start to think more critically about what I believed. And so I learned a lot about feminism and queer theory and race studies and like disability theory and all these things because I declared a major in gender studies. I think that kind of, like you were saying, started to give me a language as to how to describe the things that I was had experienced and was experiencing and was witnessing throughout my life.
Right.
But I just never really like knew how to like quantify it. I didn't think it was like scientific enough. I didn't think that there was like other people that were experiencing those things. And so it gave me a lot of insight as to what I already knew. But the fascinating part about that was that so much of that learning was happening through white women teaching me. And that was challenging because I was also beginning to recognize how much I had foregone to make myself palatable to people my whole life. And I began to feel also more free to explore those parts of who I was in relation to what I was studying. So it was just like this interesting time in my life. So I unlearned a lot at that time, and then I learned a lot of things as well. But with the new kind of like language and frame of reference, I couldn't help but also like pay attention to the microaggressions that were happening, that I was witnessing in my racialized professors, or right. seeing them experience things at the hands of like white tenured like feminist women. And so that was interesting for me. And then another side of learning was also volunteering at a rape crisis center.
Right.
I started doing that when I was like maybe 19. And I think that in addition to my like bachelor's degree really gave me like volunteering at a rape crisis center gives you like hands-on understanding as to like what the fuck is really going on. I think you learn about stuff in school and then you don't, it feels like it's all theory. And this was really applied learning. And then the applied learning took even more application in my life after my sexual assault in like second year of university. And it was so wild for me because like I knew that it wasn't my fault. I knew all these things, but yet I was still grappling with like so much like internalized misogynoir of myself, of like, oh my God, am I like who, like, ugh, like I, just so much disgust. And so that experience was like a whole gut punch, honestly. And that was and continues to be like a source of so much pain and a lot of anger that's really culminated into me seeking both liberation from the trauma and then like seeking all the vindication and seeking some sort of path to disrupt misogyny and patriarchy and violence. And then like another set of like learning for me has just been like social media. I've learned a lot. And I think as a person who's racialized, I've also recognized how inundated I've been feeling with all this information of like Black death and Brown death. And so I can't turn away from those things. And the more you see, the more you kind of feel like this moral imperative to know more, you know?
Yeah. Yeah. So you talked.
That was long. Sorry.
No, it's all important. And yeah, you talked a little bit about your journey through unlearning anti-blackness and the development of your racial consciousness as a Black woman. And obviously I know you as someone who's so like beautifully pro-Black.
I know, right?
So yeah. Yeah. Can you share a little bit about some of the Black writers and thinkers, creators, activists, you know, all the people that where you felt like the most supported or nourished or inspired or?
Yeah, totally. I feel there's a lot. I have a list. But I just want to say the reason why I am drawn to Black women and Black femmes and their writing and their work in general is that they give me the language and validate my experiences in a very, very, very tangible way. So like the hurt that I'm feeling, I can go and I can seek people like, you know, Janet Mock or Bell Hooks or Amanda Seales, like I said, she's bae. And Lashav Kinfolk Collective was actually, this is a collective that I stumbled my way into on Facebook when I was probably 21, 22. And that really was like a big, 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 like blowing of my mind.
Yeah.
I had never witnessed so much ardent protection of Black people and Black culture so public. And it really allowed me to, first of all, witness it and become oriented to that. Because so far in my life, I had, like I said, been living a really watered down version of me, I felt, or at least felt I had to make myself more palatable for folks to understand me or to spend time with me or to date me or to be in my life or whatever else. And so that was like a really big Kinfolk Collective was a huge part of my learning. And then like the Knowles sisters, like Beyonce and Solange, obviously Ijeoma Oluo, Scotty Beam, Patrice Cancoolers from Black Lives Matter, who was one of like the women, one of the black queer women who is at the helm of Black Lives Matter. All of these women are foundational to my learning, because a lot of the times I'm at a loss and then I go to these people and these places where I can find this information, and it's spoken in my own, in a language that feels relevant to me.
Yeah. So here's a question we might get. So anticipating this question. So why do you think being seen, or specifically women of color being seen,
right,
why is that something you care about? So why care about that and not just care about like humans being seen, or like kindness, or like the betterment of humanity and like in general?
Yeah, that's a good question, and I know we're probably gonna get that. Yeah, I don't think, unpopular opinion, not between the two of us, but maybe between like everybody else, is like, I don't think that we can focus on all the kumbaya shit yet. Because like the idea is that we're supposed to all like love each other and like love one another without being critical. But without being critical of like who is unloved, who has been unloved, who has been marginalized, who's never known love. And I think the kumbaya is just another easy way for us to really minimize the voices of experience and experiences of people who still feel hurt, who still are hurting. And I think you can't really fix what you don't want to see. And the more we see the shit that's fucked up and we name it and identify it and like get at the root causes and the manifestations of it, the more we do that, the more we can like show kindness and compassion to those people who actually really do need it.
Yeah.
So for me, I'm like more on the tip of like, let's find justice as opposed to like trying to find kumbaya peace, because justice means that people who are like underserved and undervalued and hurt can find some semblance of like restoring themselves to a place where they've never actually been, as opposed to trying to like get everybody who's already been benefiting off of things like white supremacy and capitalism and colonialism and all these other destructive things more piece of the pie. So
yeah,
I just got
chills. No justice, no peace.
No justice, no peace. What do you think? Like, why do you, I'm gonna assume that you're gonna take off of what I'm saying. But yeah, like, why do you think this idea of being seen is important? And like, also, why do you think that maybe like other folks don't talk about being seen?
Yeah, like going off of what you said, I do agree with everything that you said. And I think that, you know, people who see themselves everywhere don't have to ask questions about what it means to be seen.
Right.
Because to them, that's just, it's just like, you know, in the air that they breathe, right? Yeah. They don't have to ask questions about what it's like to breathe because they know.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. And like when you turn on the TV and you, you know, open the newspaper. I mean, I guess it's not the 90s anymore.
Do people scroll open on your feeds on Instagram stories?
But like going to school, like I grew up, like it wasn't until my last year of undergrad that I had a woman of color as a teacher in my entire life. Right. I grew up in rural BC, in a town where it was like 96% white. There were no other brown girls in my grade. There were no black people in my grade. There wasn't a single person who looked like me anywhere in the media.
Yeah.
You know, until like the end of high school, I think there was like one. It was like that movie Bend It Like Beckham.
And I was saying, like, that was the first time that I saw a brown person.
Yeah. And then also, and then I was like, oh, I don't relate to her at all. That's weird. You know, it's like the first time, because it's, again, like,
it's set in such a specific context that has
it's one brown girl. Right? Whereas like you see these like white dudes who have lived their entire lives where like every fucking TV show and movie and book and every, you know, that's ever been celebrated.
Do we really need more of the same shit?
Exactly. And like, it's just, it, you start to think that there's something wrong with you.
Yeah.
Right? Because if you can't see yourself anywhere, you start to think there must be some reason.
Yeah, you become the deficit. You know, and I mentioned it before, it's like whiteness as the default, or whiteness as what normal means.
Yeah.
Can just engulf people of color to make us feel as though we have to align ourselves with what whiteness is.
Yeah.
Or what whiteness pretends to be, or what whiteness, and let's be real, whiteness is predicated in white supremacy. There's no such thing as like white culture. White culture is inherently violent.
Because there were ethnicities, right, that like individual European ethnic groups had, and that was given up for this like shared racial identity that was predicated on power and superiority.
Exactly.
Yeah. So you talked a little bit about that for you, like feeling like you had to sort of live up to that, or you had to like embody that in some way, make who you were more palatable.
Yeah.
So now, do you feel like you are able to show up as who you are? Like, do you feel like there's congruence between who you really are and how, like, who you are when you walk out into the world?
Good question. I will say no. No, I don't think so. I think even though I know a lot more about myself and about the things I'm trying to push back on, I recognize the way that I take up space is very different than the way that, let's say, a white man takes up space.
Right.
Like, if I want to express, let's say I'm having a really bad day and I'm out in public and like something really catastrophically awful happened. This actually did happen to me. Like a few years ago, my ex broke up with me in a Blends on Broadway. And I was bawling my motherfucking eyes out.
Yeah.
And then I was like, take it back to your fucking house. I want to like go back to your house and get all my shit. Fuck you. I hate you. And then I got my shit and I was like, this is in the West End. And I'm on the corner and I'm just crying. Like I'm not dressed disheveled. Like I'm just like me, right? And the amount of people that walked past me and said absolutely nothing, in fact, avoided me. No one, like, and there were people, like grown men, people, like adults, not children, like who, if I saw somebody crying like the way that I was, because I was so hurt and felt so humiliated and this relationship was over, no one did anything. And I think after that, I quickly learned like, whoa, people don't show up for Black women in public spaces.
Yeah.
Fast forward to a few months ago when I'm like on the C bus and some white dude is having, I don't know, some sort of bad day or a bad trip. I don't fucking know. But he's just like yelling at the fucking bottom of his lungs like, fuck, fuck. But like, he seems relatively coherent. He's not drunk. Like, he's not slurring his speech. And then at some point, I, like, catch eyes with him. And he wanted this validation. Like, he saw me. And I think he was, like, it kind of got him, like, going off again. And I just, it hit me. Like, if I did something like that, security would be called immediately. Yeah,
absolutely.
Right? I walk into Shoppers Drug Mart and people follow me around. So it's like, I feel like I still have to, I walk into Shoppers Drug Mart and I'm like, I say hello, I greet the staff. I have my hands very visible so people can see so I don't get followed. You know, I don't try to hide things. I have my bag. I choose a bag based off of where I know I'll be going so they know that people won't think that I'm trying to shoplift. Like these things that we always do so that people feel more comfortable around us so that we don't get like over policed.
Yeah. So it's like very tangible ways in which you have to see yourself through other people's eyes and change like how you express yourself and how you exist in the world based on how those other people see you.
Yes. And like Amanda Seales has this like a shirt. And she has a comedy sketch and like a segment of it. She talks about how Black am I going to have to get? And it's a joke because it's like, sometimes I'm like, I'm at work. I don't think I can get that Black. But then at the same time, like there's this, I think in some spaces, an expectation that you're going to be this like sassy Black friend. So if you deviate from that space or you have a bad day and you're at work or something like that. Like I had a conversation with several Black women at this event. We were all kind of just sitting and like shooting the shit, talking about our own experiences. And one of the things we talked about was as Black women, when you're like having a bad day, the amount of like pushback and the amount of like attention that seems to garner from people who don't know how to deal with like the fact that you're either like super sassy Black friend or like you know, you got to be just like one version of yourself,
right?
And the nuance and the complexity is really flattened, like you were saying. And that's just really exhausting. So we're not doing that anymore.
No.
And sometimes we feel like we have to in order for us to be welcome back into like spaces, like, you know, or go back into work or be in relationships with people or feel safe even.
Yeah, like you're talking about literal physical safety in the world.
Yeah.
And at my job, at my serving job, like I have to, in order to get by in that job, there's a lot of like shifting that I have to do. So we don't always have the ability or like the luxury of being who we actually, the fullness of who we are.
Totally.
Still.
Yeah.
In 2019.
Yeah. Can you imagine?
Yeah.
I mean, I can. You live it.
Yeah.
Right? Maybe, like, we could perhaps share with folks like what kinds of things we want to keep on talking about with respect to our podcast and the types of topics we want to talk about, because I think we've delved into like who we are, what we're hoping to do.
Yeah. So we want to talk about some of this stuff, like taking up space. So what does that mean? How can we keep it radical?
Yeah.
How do we show up as who we are in the world? Like, what work do we need to do to even know who we are?
Right.
To show up in the world.
Yeah. And we're going to talk about like the things that we choose to not share with people, the things that are intimate and personal to us. We're going to talk about things like spirituality. We're going to talk about what, from our perspectives, what do Black and Brown girls actually like need from us? There's a lot of things that I think we can draw from, but also there are living, breathing Black and Brown girls that exist, and we're going to try to delve into the things that they've already told us they need from us. We're going to also talk about the danger of being a pick-me. And I think if you don't know what being a pick-me is, it's important for us to like orient ourselves to language, so Google that shit. And how not to have trash politics. That was a good one.
That's an important one.
I named that. I named that episode. But yeah, like, because we always talk about, like, what's your personal politics look like? And it doesn't require you to have a PhD or a master's degree or any degree. I think it requires us to, like, listen. And
yeah, to have emotional intelligence.
Totally.
Yeah. To, like, feel our feelings and have empathy for other people's feelings.
Yes.
We're going to talk about all of those things. We're going to talk about in the aftermath of the Me Too movement, or as the Me Too movement grows and expands, what's changed really for survivors and what comes next.
Yeah. We're going to talk about being Canadian and just like what things are like here, because I think we always talk about how, and we consume a lot of American media, and we spend so much time looking at the States, but we neglect sometimes to understand what's happening in the Canadian context. So we're going to really just like talk about that stuff.
We're going to talk about music as a tool for self-discovery. Yeah. That's something we both love music. It's
totally
about like 60 to 70% of what we talk about on any given day. So we're going to definitely devote some time to that.
Yes. And then we're also going to talk about white feminism and white femininity. Why? Because we can't not fucking talk about that shit.
Yeah, it's a menace to us all.
Yes. So we're going to be talking about all those things and more, but always through this lens of centering queer people, centering communities of color, and centering their perspectives and our perspective.
Through this lens of what it means to show up as women of color, as queer women of color,
what it means to show up for each other.
Yeah, and what it means to give the world what we have.
Exactly.
That the world, we can see that the world desperately needs it.
Totally.
So we're going to be doing that work to figure out how do we
take up space and be seen.
Yeah.